If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show right here, your source for cool jazz and more. EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Girl of the North Country, performed by Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash, recorded on this day in 1969. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're going to spend the next half an hour talking about Ritalin and our children. Dr. Sroof's article is Ritalin and the Hyperactive Child that was in the New York Times a couple of Sundays ago, and it really struck a chord with me as I read it, realizing 3 million children in this country take drugs for, we say, focusing, as he talks about in this article. And Dr. Sroof is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Minnesota's Institute of Child Development, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
This has been a debate we've been having for a long time in America, and I think that a lot of our listeners right now have children who are taking one of these medications that you talk about in your article, and a lot of question why. And one of the critical questions you ask and is being debated is whether or not attention deficit disorder is an organic disease or not.
That's one of the questions. The other question is whether it is or not, are these medications effective in treating it? I mean, I think it is questionable whether most of these children are born with an inherent defect in their brains. It's not questionable that there are a lot of troubled children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not questionable that if you study the brains of a group of troubled children, you'll find that their brains will be functioning differently. The thing is, we don't know where the problems came from, and we don't know where the brain differences came from. They could both be the result of the same thing.
And you began your career as a psychologist. You supported the idea of amphetamine-based drugs, Ritalin being given to kids to help them focus when they couldn't focus in school or had other kinds of deficit disorders, right?
There was a great deal of research beginning in the 1960s and continuing for some time showing that stimulant medication produced short-term changes in these children. The thing is, almost all of the studies that were done, the controlled studies, were done just over a period of a few weeks. And yes, like it helps college students, like it helps anyone, like it helped World War II radar operators, stimulant drugs help you focus your attention. But the question is, will that benefit continue after the child has been on the medication for a number of weeks, or do the results fade? And to answer that question, you need long-term studies.
Which is what you've been part of conducting.
I personally did not conduct a long-term drug study, but there now have been several. And what prompted my article was the fact that the most recent study, the very best study that's been done to date on the long-term outcomes, failed to find any evidence for that. And while this study, like any study, has its shortcomings, it's the best study yet done. And no study to date has demonstrated long-term benefit. All the studies that have been good studies demonstrate short-term benefits, but no study to date has demonstrated long-term benefit.
So one of the things I found, before I come read some of the letters to the editor that were written in response, which I found interesting, I'm curious your response to them. I think let's talk a bit about what I think is kind of at the core of what you've been writing, which is that the connection between experience, what children experience in their lives, is, and the developing brain. And we go ahead.
It is one of the most exciting findings in neuroscience in the last two decades, that the developing brain is heavily influenced by experience. We know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. That doesn't mean that some children are not born with variations in their brain, but it does mean that we have to consider experience as well as any conditions a child may be born with. And it brings to light the fact that simple brain differences between children do not prove that the differences were inborn. They could be the result of experience.
Let's talk about what that means. I mean, one of the things I found really interesting here about the some of the stuff that you were compositing and that I really want to explore in some greater depth is Ritalin and the use of these drugs, especially among kids who live in intense poverty.
Yes.
And what that experience does to the developing brain and to our children and to their effect of their behavior.
You've put your finger right on the problem. My main point was not that there are no children that are helped by these medications. My main points were, number one, there's no evidence that the medications help long term. Number two, we don't know nearly enough about the side effects of these drugs. We know some things about the side effects that are very troubling, like that the drugs interfere with growth. And we know that they do that because the drugs have an impact on hormone excretion. So they disrupt the excretion of growth hormone, and that's why they impact growth. So we have a drug that we know impacts hormone. Do we want to be giving that to 3 million children from the time they're young through their adolescence? That was the main whistle I wanted to blow. Before we do that, I mean, I wish it had been before we did it, we need a lot more information about what are these drugs doing. Are they really helping the children? That's question number one. If they're not helping, we don't want to do it. Number two, it could even be worse. They could be harming some children. It's possible, of course, that there's some children that the drugs harm and some that they help. We have no clue right now.
And we have no clue partially because all the research money are going in directions other than that.
All the research right now, or the vast bulk of it, is assuming that we already have the answer. It's assuming that ADD is an inborn disorder of the nervous system, and it's assuming that, therefore, because it's an inborn disorder, it must be treated with drugs. Neither of those statements are logical. Even if it was an inborn disorder, that doesn't mean drugs are the effective treatment. You have to ask that question by doing long-term outcome studies and showing that, in fact, children given the drugs do better than children not. And that's what I'm saying is absent in the literature.
But this is really critical. I mean, because it seems to me that there are a couple other issues here that popped out at me as I was reading this. And it's not just an issue of poverty, because chaos can be in any child's life.
Absolutely.
Right? And one of the things I never thought, I mean, I never even thought about or read about, was when you wrote about patterns of parental intrusiveness that involve stimulation for which the baby is not prepared. In other words, describe that, because that's something that I mean, we don't even think about, which I think is critical. Even if you are a parent who reads their child and thinks with their kid and does all these wonderful things you're supposed to do with your children, this is something that I think a threshold we never think about crossing.
I want to say first, I was certainly not intending to alarm a bunch of parents and to make a bunch of parents feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
My own studies would never lead me to that conclusion, because in my own studies, where we got to know these 200 families in detail, every one of them was trying to do the best for their child.
Right, right.
Every one of them cared about their child. Number two, one of the main things we found, and I'll get to the overstimulation.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But one of the main things we found was the impact of stress that families were experiencing. When families are experiencing high stress, so is the child,
mm-hmm.
inevitably. And what we found was that stress was one of the best predictors of these later symptoms, behaviors that are called ADD. Moreover, since we tracked these families year by year, we found that as the stress decreased, so did the ADD and other behavior symptoms. This is one of the main reasons I would never blame parents, because it's primarily the stress that families are under that I would point to as a culprit. Now, when families are under stress, there's already a climate of heavy stimulation because people are tense, people are anxious, people are worried. That's stimulating to a child. In addition to which, when parents are under stress, they have a more difficult time responding to their children in a calm way. You can just imagine yourself, you come home, you're all strung out, you had some fights at work, you're really tired, it's been a bad day, and your child is acting up. Well, it's very easy to want to tell that child to just be quiet and to be punitive, as opposed to be calm and reassuring and sit down and have a nice conversation with them. That was one of the things we measured was specifically the patterns of stimulation in the family, but we saw those as related to the stress that they were under.
I think that is a really critical piece here, that because people do get very nervous about being criticized and it being a bad parent, but this has a lot to do with the way our society is kind of wired right now and almost hardwired.
Indeed. We got parents that have two jobs. We have parents where between the two of them they have four jobs.
Right.
We have people who are having to move from place to place. We have lots of instability. This is very hard on families. The reason I wrote this article was not to criticize parents. It was because of my concern for the parents and the children in these families. We need to be offering them more. And frankly, I think while the medication looks like a simple solution, it's certainly a cheap solution. It's a solution insurance companies want to pay for. It's a solution that brings in billions, literally billions of dollars to the pharmaceutical company. And I'd be happy to tell you the actual facts on that. It's rather startling how
tell
much
us.
Money they bring in. Okay. In 2006, $4 billion in sales. In 2010, $7.4 billion. There's no mystery to what is the huge force behind this. It's profitable for them. It's easy for the insurance companies. It's easy for everybody, except if it doesn't really work, it's hard on the children. And that's why we need to have studies. My argument about overstimulation in the environment wasn't that that's the only factor. It was to say, this is something we're not even looking at. And yet, if you take our research, which was carefully done, the most comprehensive study of development that has ever been done, and what we found was these patterns of stimulation, not the infant's activity level, not the infant's neurological status at birth, that predicted the later ADHD symptoms. So all I was arguing was, my gosh, we've got to be looking at a broader picture. We've got to look at stress. We've got to look at social support. We've got to do more to help teachers and our schools cope with these children so they're not wanting the kids to be put on drugs. You can see I have very strong feelings.
Yes.
They developed over 40 years of studying this and thinking about it and watching this grow. When I started, the first paper I wrote on this, the first review, there were 150,000 children on these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1973. By the early 1990s, it was 700,000. By the end of the 1990s, it was 2 million.
Mm.
Now it's 3. And going up.
We're talking to Dr. Alan Sroof, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Minnesota's Institute of Child Development, who wrote an op-ed piece, an opinion piece in the New York Times, January 28th, called Ritalin Gone Wrong. And Andrea, you're on the air.
I have your article in my classroom. I love it. Because I've seen two educators, and I just wanted to see what you thought when you talked about the overstimulation, that sometimes, too, we're guilty of it in our classrooms, and the teachers don't realize, and they're like, oh, I want a referral so they can get on medicine. I'm like, no, wait a minute. You don't know what it's going to do. You don't know what the effects are. You know, have you ever thought about taking it? You know, they think, oh, you got to put red, you got to put blue, you got to have all this stuff. It's like, let's take some stuff out of our classroom. Let's take our kids outside and let them kind of breathe and relax and kind of calm down and get some fresh air and just kind of talk to them kind of about how their day is going. Because it's kind of like you mentioned, there may be someone that's moving around. They might not have slept the night before because they spent all night moving, or, you know, mom and dad were fighting. So I don't know. I just kind of wonder what you thought, or even just ways that we as educators can kind of help children, because I'm always open for learning new ideas on how, you know, I can make their experience a lot better when they come to school and they're in my care.
Thank you, Andrea.
That's a wonderful thing to hear from a teacher. And I want to tell you that I heard from a number of teachers and school psychologists and principals, and I was surprised to find that the majority of them have the same viewpoint you do, that we're using this too much. I could send some things via email. And the caller can find my email by clicking on that New York Times thing, or I'm pretty easy to find on the internet, because I could send you some work that's going on with trying to help teachers. Before we move on to another question, though, I want to tell you that I think teachers need more help, and it's not just smaller classroom sizes. I think every classroom should have two teachers in it so that one teacher can sit down with kids that are struggling. Because I know it's a very difficult thing for a teacher. She's trying to work with the whole class, and a lot of times it's not possible to take 15 minutes out for the one child that's really needing to be settled. So to the extent I have a plan, I'm sure it sounds like pie in the sky, but hey, why can't we afford to do this? In countries like Germany and France and England, they don't use medications anything like what we do. They rarely use them, and they still manage to have their schools functioning.
What about the people who wrote in, and we'll come back to our calls here, Dante and Clarence, the next two callers up, that one of the letters to the editor talked about Ritalin saving her child's life. She's a pathologist, saying her son's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder made it impossible for him to play with other children, becoming violent with frustration, and now he can deal with life, and because he was diagnosed to have minimal brain dysfunction, ADHD, and Ritalin has allowed her son to flourish. So are there not some children?
I had a number of letters like that, although, frankly, I had more that said that it didn't work for their child. But what I always wrote back was, I'm really happy that you found it to be effective. I guess the physicians I know a number of physicians that I respect greatly for how they handle this. What they say is, first, you try everything else. And very possibly, this parent tried everything else. They tried changing classrooms. They tried working with the schools. They tried having family counseling. They did everything they could, and it wasn't working. They tried medication, and it works. I would say then that's the time to use medication. At the same time, of course, you keep your eye on trying to take the child off. Many parents wrote about not having the child on medication during the summer, taking them off during the weekend, always having their eye on making the medication be prescribed for the shortest amount of time possible. That makes sense, and I know there are people who feel very strongly that the medication helped. I'm not saying we shouldn't have any of these drugs in existence. I'm saying we should have a lot of other options available to families, options that they can try first. This long-term study, this really excellent study called the MTA study, where they had a controlled design. Some kids were placed on stimulant medication and some were not, and they followed them over time. Here's what they found about substance abuse. First of all, children given behavior therapy had less substance abuse than children given medication 2 years later. So the medication was not as helpful as behavior therapy. Secondly, now this is about delinquency, 2 years later and 3 years later, more days of prescribed medication were associated with more serious delinquency. Those are both findings from the best study yet done on the outcome. There has never been evidence that treating these children leads to less substance abuse or less delinquency. And now we have this study raising questions about its effectiveness with both substance abuse and delinquency. As we now continue to medicate on up into college, kids get to college and, of course, they start finding ways to get multiple prescriptions and selling these things to other kids, and kids grind it up and snort it. There's a very interesting interview that I read with a DEA official talking about this problem. His name is Agent Boggs, and he said his agency is concerned that ADHD drug abuse is on the rise. We see people abuse it in college and then continue to abuse it non-medically once they leave college. The Drug Enforcement Agency is actually quite against this practice of medicating these millions of children.
The DEA.
The DEA. Not the FDA.
Right.
The FDA seems to work rather more closely with drug companies.
There's a revolving door there.
The vast majority of the drugs that are prescribed now are all stimulants. Ritalin is a stimulant. Adderall is a combination of dexedrine and methamphetamine. That's dexedrine and dextroamphetamine.
Right.
Not methamphetamine.
Right.
They're stimulants. caffeine is a stimulant. If you look at the chemical charts, Ritalin looks about halfway between caffeine and dexedrine. They're all stimulants, and they're used because stimulants do help individuals focus attention short term. Many college students know this. That's why they take it when they're cramming for exams. They help you keep your mind on things that are boring and tedious. But the problem is there also is a lot of tolerance for these drugs, meaning that as you use them, either you need a larger dosage or they stop being effective. And for a long time, we thought that children didn't develop tolerance. That was the lore out there. But there's no evidence to support that idea. And there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that they do develop tolerance. After all, their sleeplessness and loss of appetite fade after a few weeks. What makes us think that the beneficial effects don't fade?
So what are the alternatives to Ritalin, and as you described in the end of your article, what is it that we could be doing that we don't do? That what kind of discussion should we be having about an alternative to giving 3 million children, maybe millions more, Ritalin?
The first thing we need is to understand is that these kids are quite varied. This idea that there's this singular disease and that millions of kids have it and they need this drug, these kids are quite varied in their behavior. Probably they're quite varied in the causes, and they're probably quite varied in the interventions that would be effective. Sometimes a kid just needs to be put in a different classroom. Sometimes a kid needs a more structured school environment than the school environment they're in. Sometimes it's issues in the family. There've been a lot of conflict between the parents or a nasty divorce. Sometimes these kids are just highly anxious. They're worried about stuff, and they need some individual help with that. But basically what I'd like to see is the comprehensive array of things available to families. And that would include the ability to have meetings where the family and perhaps a school psychologist or other behavioral scientist and the teachers and the child all sit down together and work up a strategy for helping this child get along better. So there isn't a single panacea, and I feel badly that I can't point to one.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I wrote this article is I'd like to see us get on the job of trying to come up with these solutions. I'd like to see a lot more work on that and a lot less work on showing yet again that the brains of these kids are different one from another. Because, of course, they are, and that doesn't help us understand anything about how to help the kid.
Dr. Alan Sarouf has been our guest this last half hour. An incredible article which you can link to on our website, steinershow.org, Ritalin Gone Wrong. We'll continue this conversation in greater depth in the weeks and months to come. Alan Sarouf is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Minnesota's Institute of Child Development. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much for taking this time with us and our listeners today.
Well, nice talking with you, Mark, and your listeners. Those were all great comments and questions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues that impact Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's marylandeducators.org. On our way to break, that's Eclipse by Pink Floyd, recorded on this day in 1972.
Fight, and all that is love.